Most of you are aware that I spent this past week in Detroit at the 221st General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church. I was there to testify about my experiences in Israel and Palestine and to advocate for our denomination to take concrete steps to align our financial entanglements with our morality. Money and morals. Two things which don't seem to go together very often in our world. Our money and our morals often live in separate ghettos of our minds, never meeting, certainly rarely aligning with one another. In the city of Motown, I heard commissioners asking, when it comes to our investments, what's love got to do with it? It's nothing personal, goes the cliche, as shrugging shoulders dismiss the suffering of another neighbor. It's just business. The main action which I was in Detroit to support was to accept the recommendation of the Mission Responsibility Through Investment Committee to divest all holdings in three American companies which do business in a way that benefits from the ongoing illegal occupation of Palestine by the State of Israel. It has been our long-standing policy as a denomination not to invest in companies that profit from non-peaceful pursuits and selling weaponized bulldozers to knock down thousands of Palestinian homes, as Caterpillar does, is definitely a non-peaceful pursuit. Creating biometric scanners and identity badges so that people can be segregated on the basis of ethnicity and subject to constant human rights violations, as Hewlett-Packard does, is definitely a non-peaceful pursuit. Selling communications and surveillance technology used by military forces to illegally occupy another nation as Motorola Solutions does is definitely a non-peaceful pursuit. Some opponents of divestment argue that we shouldn't hold these companies responsible for supporting the violence of the occupation because they are just selling their goods. If not Caterpillar, somebody else would come along who would sell bulldozers to the Israeli Defense Force. It's not Caterpillar's responsibility how their bulldozers are used, they would argue. But this argument to me reeks too much of Pilate washing his hands of the crucifixion before handing Jesus over to the soldiers to do the real bloody work. The fatalism expressed by people who say it is inevitable that the market will supply even immoral demands, no matter what we do, ironically exposes the underlying conflict in our society between our money and our morality. We cannot serve both God and mammon, Jesus once said, mammon being the Canaanite name for the god of wealth and greed. Money and morality are in a wrestling match. One will be made to serve the other. If our money is not subject to our morality, then our morality will become subject to the whims of money. At the present time, it is completely clear to me that money is dominant over morality in our society. Did you realize that while there are 3.5 million people experiencing homelessness in America, that there are actually over 8 million vacant homes? Many of those homes were foreclosed upon and are unlikely to sell anytime in the near future. We as a society prefer to defend the rights of ownership for banks to hold effectively worthless properties empty rather than see people experiencing homelessness housed. While I was in Detroit, I walked through districts where nearly every building on the street was abandoned, covered with plywood, and signs and notices from local businesses indicating that they had gone out of business. Whole skyscrapers with 50 stories shuttered. Thousands and thousands of square feet of shelter completely unused and sleeping under the eaves of these unused buildings. The former factory workers and service industry professionals who used to work inside those very buildings, but now live on the street, the economy having collapsed out from underneath them. The demands of money moved the money elsewhere, and people were collateral damage in the process. The poor are not poor because there isn't enough to go around. They're sleeping on the street while houses are empty. They are starving while others grow fat. They're unemployed while corporate profits achieve record highs. What we're seeing here is not a famine. It is not a natural disaster. It is oppression. off the tap water in Detroit. Because poverty there has reached 40%, and over half of the accounts of the public tap water system are in arrears, unable to pay money owed to the system for their water. The water is there, but the people will go thirsty. Money over morality. If you can't afford it, you apparently don't have the right in our country to housing, to food, to water, to health care, to police protection, you name it. You begin to wonder whether our society thinks poor people have a right to live. And then you hear the Congressman Stephen Fincher just 2 weeks ago actually said on the House of the floor of the Representatives that we should let the elderly, disabled, and those unable to work in our society die. And he had the gall to try to justify this with a quote from the Bible. The Bible also says that whatever we do to the least of these, we do to Jesus. Jesus will judge us on how we treat the poor and oppressed in our society, and if we let them die, I don't think the judgment is going to be kind. This kind of poverty isn't poverty because there is a lack in our society. This kind of poverty is poverty because it has been enforced by our society. Because some people are forcibly kept away from the means to support themselves or to be supported by others. While I was in Detroit, while I was at the assembly, a woman came up to me who was wandering around the conference center. We were in this huge conference center, so I was at one far end of the conference center, and she came up to me and she asked me for money. And she was clearly in distress. She'd been sleeping on the street for a while. She was not clean, and she was very confused about where she was. There may have been mental health issues, but she came up to me and very politely asked me if I could give her some money for breakfast. So I gave her a $20 bill out of my wallet. And immediately I was chided by others around me for being a sucker, for having compassion for this woman. Later on, about half an hour later, I had moved down to the other end of the assembly, and I watched as this woman had also made her way down to the other end of the assembly. And the security of the conference center had finally caught wind of this, and they immediately laid hands on her, grabbed her, and dragged her screaming out of the conference center, out onto the street, to be removed. She never laid a hand on anyone. She never did anything but ask for money. Her crime was being in need of others, and she was forcibly lifted and dragged, screaming and asking them to let her go out into the street to be thrown away. The reason being that the members of the assembly, like myself, had to be protected, apparently, from this woman's vulnerability, from this woman's need. We needed to be defended from seeing her poverty. And the irony is that these security guards who removed her were doing so on orders. It is not their fault that they acted so. They were doing so on orders. And I guarantee you that those security guards themselves, are closer in income to the woman who was asking for money than to those of us who were sitting in the assembly waiting to be defended. We're asking the poor to defend us from the poor. This week, President Obama announced that he's going to send 300 soldiers back to Iraq, that country that we wrecked 12 years ago to protect our oil interests in the Middle East. We have to send soldiers back again to protect ourselves once more because the violence has spiraled out of control yet again. These soldiers who we're sending there overwhelmingly come from the poorest ranks of our society. Most who join the military in our society do so because it's possibly their only opportunity to get a college education. It's like a twisted real-world version of the Hunger Games, where you have to go to a foreign country and dodge bullets for a few years in order to earn the right in our country to come back and receive an education. And if you come back and you haven't been wrecked by PTSD, or been blown up by an IED, or had your limbs lost and sit forever in a veteran system which is falling apart around you and failing to give you the care you need, then maybe you might be fortunate enough to get an education and go on to have a job with which you can support your family. Money over morality. But it does not have to be this way. The state of Utah, quietly, over the past 8 years, has managed to decrease homelessness in their state by 78%. They are on track to end homelessness by the year 2015, by the end of 2015. And the way that they have done this is the most simple and obvious way possible, by giving every homeless person an apartment. They have learned, they have discovered, that in fact the cost for each person experiencing homelessness on their streets to society in ER visits and prison time is over $17,000 per person per year that is spent by the state of Utah to handle homeless people. And they discovered that the cost to furnish an apartment and a social worker per year will be $11,000. That they could save $6,000 a year per person on the street by simply giving them an apartment with no strings attached, by the way. It doesn't have to be money over morality. We can choose the alternate way. We can choose to worship God instead of worshiping mammon. While I was at the assembly, I was fortunate enough to work together with a group of people calling themselves Jewish Voices for Peace. These are young Jewish Americans who believe that the occupation in Israel and Palestine is unjust and are trying to work and advocate to help change the process, to help change the conversation. And so we were having interfaith collaboration with this organization, trying to work with the assembly to change the assembly's mind about how it should spend its money. And on the last day of the assembly, on Friday, before the assembly would meet together to take the crucial vote, which we had been working toward all week, we got together, these young Jews, these young Christians who've been working together in the Presbyterian Church to try to do this, and we held a prayer session outside the assembly hall. We held hands, and I taught them a song, which I want to teach you now. It's a very simple song. It goes like this. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Those words being, of course, the English word for peace, the Arabic word for peace, and the Hebrew word for peace together in this song. So it's very simple. I want you to sing it with me here for a second.
Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom.
For Israel,
peace, salam, shalom.
For Palestine,
peace, salam, shalom.
For the Bedouin,
peace, salam, shalom.
For all people,
peace, salam, shalom.
We sang the song again and again. 15, 20 minutes, and as we sang it, we invited the people who were walking by us to join us in the circle. And the circle, which began with about 15 hands, slowly grew. Commissioners, liberal, conservative, people from the Midwest, people from the Northeast, people from the South, people from California, people from the Pacific Northwest, people from the Rocky Mountains, started taking hands with each other and joining in and singing in the song with us together, praying for peace for Israel, for Palestine, for all people throughout the world, singing together our commitment that our money shall not rule over our morality, but it shall be the other way around. Even if it is at cost to ourselves, we shall do what is right, we shall do what is just, we shall stand with our God, with the poor, with the oppressed, rather than standing with those who oppress them, rather than standing with those who use their power to secure their position at the cost of the lives of millions of others. We sang and we sang, and when we got to a point where we had more hands than we could possibly see each other across the circle, more rings began forming inside the circle. And when we had maybe 150 people all singing the song together, we drew everyone singing the song down into a into a hum. And one of our Jewish rabbi friends walked into the middle of the circle and she began praying. She began praying aloud with all of us, saying that she longed for God's justice to roll down, as Amos had predicted. She longed for the money changers to be thrown out of the temple and for it to be once again to become a house of prayer for all nations. She longed for a day when people, when Christians would stand to reflect the values of Jesus in the world rather than reflecting the values of the powerful. She longed for a day when Jews would reflect the values of God's love, of Tikkun Olam, to heal and to mend the whole world. She longed for a time when there wouldn't be any argument from any side that it was ever justifiable for the sake of a prophet that you should make that prophet off the sweat and blood of another human being. And when we concluded the prayer, we sang again very loud, and we went into the assembly with our hearts very fragile and weak, waiting to see what the assembly would decide. And the debate was intense. And the debate was hard. The debate was complex. And we acknowledged that there are people of good faith on all sides. And when it came down to it, the assembly voted that we cannot, in good conscience, continue to profit from non-peaceful pursuits in Israel and Palestine. And it's one issue of many. It's one way of many in our world that money has overtaken our morality. And yet, every single time that we together agree that we worship God and not man, we are one step closer to the kingdom. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, all glory and honor be unto you.